Thank you, Julie. Thank you, Becky. Power. I've been thinking about power for a really long time. In my teens, I had the opportunity to meet the president of Guatemala and made a big impact on me. And I said, that's what I want to do. I want to help the country reach its potential. In my 20s, I joined a political party. I was super excited about democratizing decision making. I also fell in love in my 20s with my beautiful and smart and grounded, beautiful and smart, like a bagel, wife, Mari. But because Mari was Mennonite, I also fell in love with the Mennonites, the Mennonite community, the Mennonite theology. I felt like I had come home to a theology that I'd always kind of believed but couldn't articulate. However, my journey with trying to understand power, where it comes from, how you get it, how you use it, how you lose it, was not made easier by being Mennonite. It's made harder. Mennonites are power averse. We don't like accumulating power, concentration of power, using power to impose our will on others. I usually find that awe-inspiring, but on occasion I feel it's naive and short-sighted. In my 30s, I got really close to power. After becoming an innovation expert, I ended up being the head of innovation for the country of Guatemala, and then the head of innovation for the largest company in the region. I became an advisor to the president, to the ministers, to the boards of directors, CEOs. I lived this bizarre tension between working with the powerful and congregating with the powerless. I'd go to a meeting during the week where we'd be talking about what to do about the protesters against the mines who are jeopardizing the stability of the country. And then on Sunday, I'd go to church and be like, brothers and sisters, let's go protest against the mines. In my 40s, I moved to Goshen, or as a friend of mine calls it, the holy city of Goshen, the Mecca of the Mennonites. And it's very different than my life in Guatemala, but it's been so wonderful to be with you guys and to learn from you guys as you wrestle out your own theology of power. I was thrilled when Anna asked me to talk about this, as you can tell. In some ways, I've been working on this sermon for 20 years. And I love the fact that the worship committee chose David. Such a complex character. You can see there at the height of his power with the tears in his eyes. That's kind of iconic of David's journey with power. The story of David is riveting. We're in church, so this is the G-rated version, but it's like a trilogy you can't put down, a TV series you have to binge on. If you're looking for good entertainment, I encourage you to go binge on 1 and 2 Samuel and 1 Kings this afternoon. You will not be disappointed. But before we recap the life of David, I want to introduce a little framework, a little thing I put together to help understand David's journey through power. We tend to think of power as unidimensional. You either have it or you don't. But really, there's lots of types of power and sources of power. And for simplicity's sake, I'm going to talk about two. One is what I'll call relational power, which is the currency of this is trust. It's the extent to which people just like you and love you and care about you. And they're willing to give up things for you, not because they have to, but because they want to. They want to see you succeed. But there's another dimension which I'll call organizational power, and the currency there is hierarchy, and the hierarchy can come from many, many different sources. Maybe you've been there the longest. Maybe you're the tallest. Maybe you're the one with the best aim. Maybe you have the most money or the most titles or the best methods or techniques or tools or weapons, but that gives you hierarchy. Now, if you have a lot of relational power but not a whole lot of organizational power, you're a force. You can inspire people to do things. If you have a lot of organizational power and no relational power, you're also a force. You're a little more coercive. You can get people to do things that they don't want to do. And of course, the ideal is that you would have both. And if you have both the credibility to have people want to do things and also the authority to make it more sustainable and institutionalized, you have transformational power. Now, if you have no power, you're powerless, and you want to get a lot of relational power, you do that by connecting, by building community. If you have no power and you want to have a lot of organizational power, you do that by competing, whether that competition is an interview process for a job or a sports tournament or a war where you're competing with your life. If you have a lot of organizational power, maybe you even inherited it from your parents, the money or the title, and you want to become a force for transformation, you have to involve the people you have power over with empathy and wisdom. And if you have a lot of relational power, usually you're pretty happy. You don't aspire to have organizational power. But at some point, you realize that if you don't step in to organizational power, something bad's going to happen, and you respond to a calling. Now let's look at David from the perspective of this framework. David starts out his life powerless. He's the most insignificant child, youngest of eight, in an insignificant town called Bethlehem, which later becomes famous because of him, but before that nobody knew what that was. And he has these bizarre experiences as a kid. One day, the head priest and head judge of Israel shows up at his doorstep and anoints him, and he knows God has chosen him for something big, but he's not sure when or how or what or why. Then he starts playing harp for the king, Saul, because King Saul gets these panic attacks and his spirit is tormented. And David, with his harp, is the only person who can calm him down. And then, of course, there's the famous story of Goliath, which I don't have to repeat. But from the moment that David kills Goliath, he starts to accumulate an enormous amount of relational power. People genuinely like him. King Saul brings him under his wing. He offers his first daughter in marriage. King Saul's son, Jonathan, who's the bravest warrior Israel has at the time, has a deep respect for David, and they end up becoming really good friends. But Saul starts to get jealous and realizes, I think this guy's going to replace me as king. He'd already been warned by Samuel, the head priest, that that was going to happen, but he didn't know who was going to replace him. But when he starts to sense that it's David, he starts to realize, I got to kill this guy. At least three times he throws his spear at David while David's playing the harp. He reneges his offer to have David marry his oldest daughter and offers another daughter, but it's a trap because he wants 100 Philistines to kill him. He says, you can marry my daughter if you kill 100 Philistines, but it doesn't work. David wins. And he kept sending David to the front lines in hopes that he'll get killed. He tries to get David at his own house, but his daughter warns him and he leaves and flees. Eventually, Jonathan says, David, you got to get out of here. My dad really is not going to stop trying to kill you. So David goes in the wilderness, and he spends a whole bunch of years as a nomad. He's not alone. He's had 650 men with him. It's a lot of mouths to feed. So they make their living by pillaging and raiding neighboring cities or by offering protection. In exchange for compensation, we heard the story of Nabal, who didn't want to offer compensation. That wasn't the only time that David restrained his power. At least twice he had the opportunity to kill Saul. Once in the cave, which we saw with Julie. Another time that Saul was sleeping. And both times, out of deep respect for the office, as Paul Keim would say, he decided not to. Eventually, Saul was fatally wounded in battle. It was a tragic day. Three of his sons died that day too, including Jonathan. And David mourns. And David mourns when Abner, Saul's general, is also killed in foul play by his own general, Joab. And he also mourns when Ishbosheth, King Saul's son, who takes over after Saul, is killed by his own men. But despite the fact that he mourns and he doesn't want to sort of step into that power, he does, and he responds to the call of the people of Israel. They say, please be our king, and he steps in. And for the most part, he rules for 40 years. For the most part, he's a pretty good king. He never gets a whole lot of peace because the neighbors are always attacking, but there are a few iconic moments that we all know about where he steps into this red quadrant of coercive organizational power. Bathsheba is one of them. He kills Uriah so he can have Bathsheba as his wife. He does the census against God's will, and God says, you can choose from three punishments. He chooses the punishment that hurts him the least. Very selfish. But probably the most relevant failure of David is as a father. His oldest sons were entitled, they were arrogant, they were a mess, a disaster. His first son, Amnon, totally devastated one of his stepsisters. David did nothing. So the third son, Absalom, plots a revenge, holds a banquet, slaughters his oldest brother, and then he has to flee. Eventually he comes back, but he thinks he can be better king than David. He gets a lot of popular support, and he declares himself king, and David has to flee in the middle of the night for his life. Eventually, Joab, David's general, kills Absalom, but David mourns the loss of his son. And then towards the end of his life, his fourth son, Adonijah, who's in line for king, he gets impatient and says, I'm going to be king. He holds a coronation banquet. And Nathan, the prophet who has constantly gone to David every time he does something wrong and says, David, you screwed up again. You should not have done that. And God's very angry at you. Nathan comes up to David at his deathbed and says, you can't let your fourth son become king. You have to make Solomon king. And keep in mind, Solomon's number 10 on the list. He's way down the succession line. There's no reason for him to be king. But David immediately enacts that, makes him king. Solomon crashes his older brother's party that very same day, ends up killing the brother and supporters, and ushers Israel into the most prosperous and peaceful time in its history. So what can we learn about power from David? I'd like to share three reflections that have impacted me about the life of David. The first reflection is that we have a bias toward relational power that I think is hurting us more than we think. We've gotten so good at seeing the futility of power, the kingdoms rise and fall, that all those fancy titles are vapor, meaningless, as Ecclesiastes would say. We've gotten so good at that that we forget that there is no shalom without organizational power. If you're not a fan of organizational power, you may forget that you're sitting on top of an entire infrastructure of organizational power that you may not like it, but it works. I invite you to go spend some time in a society where organizational power is completely dysfunctional. People spend 90% of their energy every day just trying to survive, trying to get through the day without getting killed or groped or mugged, living day to day, paycheck to paycheck, a complete incapacity to save or to become less vulnerable, constantly being taken advantage of by men, by middlemen, by people richer than them. And the church has responded to this differently throughout its history. Some branches of theology say, no, it's all about the future, not about now. Particularly the evangelical tradition I grew up in. It says, life is really about heaven, about you going to heaven, about your soul. So it's about your well-being in the future. So yeah, all this stuff is happening, but don't get involved because power corrupts. The leadership response is power corrupts. So don't get involved in fixing all those things. Philip Goldner has mentioned several times in this room that we need to pay attention to the fastest growing group of Christians in the world, the prosperity gospel, Pentecostals. For them, they're saying, no, life is so hellish for me now. I am looking for personal well-being now. And it's very attractive to think that God can intervene and make your life better now. But what happens with this theological response, the gospel of prosperity, is that it tends to generate the leadership that has a Messiah complex. That I am the hero, I can single-handedly save society. And of course, these populist leaders fail one after the other. As Anabaptists, I think we have a third response, which I'll call the Mennonite gospel. It's It's this perspective that the Bible's not about individual choices. It's not a manual for life about how to go to heaven. It's about collective decision making, about how society organizes itself so the vulnerable and the widow and the orphan have support systems. It's about embedding rest and restoration into the very fabric of our culture so that people have a day of rest. The land has a year of rest. People overburdened with debt can have respite from their debts and start over again and not pass on poverty to the next generation. The leadership response of this view, I think, is we are stewards. But what I've seen happen is that we are so averse to organizational power. We do this within our communities as Mennonites. But when the opportunities come to step into society at large as leaders, we say, no, those fancy titles aren't for me. And all we do is open the door for other people who are naive and incompetent, or not very naive and very power-hungry and incompetent, to enter and dominate organizational power, creating a living hell for the societies they dominate. Time and time again, David had the opportunity to do something, to hurt someone, to kill someone, and he chose not to. But he had the power in the first place. And I think we confuse weakness with meekness. A weak horse is powerless. A meek horse is a powerful horse that restrains his power. Yet we think, blessed are the weak, for they will inherit the earth. But that's not true. It says, blessed are the powerful who restrain their power, for they will inherit the earth. The meek. I know this may sound controversial to you, but having dealt with this for many years, I feel like we need a theology of stewardship, where we systematically prepare ourselves for power, systematically acquire power, systematically restrain power, and channel power towards shalom. So I leave you with this question. Is there an organizational role that I should be stepping into that I'm shying away from? My second reflection is that we gravitate, when we have organizational power, towards authority. I see it in my own life as a father. I have a lot of authority with my kids. I can say, don't watch YouTube, brush your teeth, go to bed. But sometimes I find myself at the end of the day realizing that every interaction I had with my kids was a command. And first glance, when you look at David, you think that the disaster with his kids is because he was a softy, but I don't think that's what was going on. If I look at my own life, I think David was so consumed by his responsibilities in organizational power that he didn't invest the energy to connect with his kids. I'll be in a meeting, my kids will come home and say, Daddy, guess what happened today? And I use my authority to say, not right now, I'm in a meeting. And then later, they tell me the story. I catch up on the story, but I can never catch up on the moment. And I feel like if we have organizational power, the only way to truly connect is to have our problems be co-felt and our solutions be co-created. But that takes energy. If I'm tired, exhausted, stressed, I don't invest in connecting. So I leave you with this question. Am I managing my energy so that I can connect in the areas of my life where I have organizational power? And my final reflection is that I believe that we need sources of spiritual awareness. Becky mentioned someone who will help you stop and think. We've talked a lot about the two dimensions, relational power, organizational power, but I think there's a third dimension, which I'm going to call spiritual awareness. And you can't see that, unfortunately. But David had different levels of spiritual awareness throughout his life. When he was powerless, he had a lot of spiritual awareness. When he started getting relational power, he had a lot of it. Once he was in organizational power, sometimes he had it, sometimes he didn't. But he had the Nathans in his life, the Abigails in his life, who said, dude, that wasn't cool. and I think to my own life. Where are the sources of spiritual awareness in my life? Part of it is this realization that I am the vine, you are the branches, apart from me, you are nothing. We can never really have power in the first place because we're just channeling God's power. But another part of it is not just surrounding yourself with cheerleaders. It's surrounding yourselves with people who will raise your spiritual awareness. And I know in my life, my wife, Mari, is so rooted in reality that she helps me see things I can't see. She says, that was a little bit selfish, that decision you made. That was very arrogant, the thing you said. And I'm grateful for that. So I leave you with this final question. Where are your sources of spiritual awareness as you journey through your life of power? And I'll finish with the last sentence of this hymn we sang, which I loved. May we be people that God stirs us into building new worlds in his name. O Spirit of God, send us your power.